One, two.
This is Culturetopia, your weekly dose of arts and culture love from NPR. I'm Elizabeth Blair at the Arts Desk.
And I'm Justine Kennan from All Things Considered, your guide today for all things cultural.
We want to remind you that you can subscribe to this podcast on our website, npr.org/culturetopia.
This week on Culturetopia,
opera singer Enrico Caruso inspires a lifelong obsession with opera.
Irish author Roddy Doyle talks about what it means to be Irish.
A look at The Last Lost and the latest Sex in the City.
And Bollywood meets telenovelas.
But first,
it could be your brother, too. Or your sister. Or your children. I want justice for all of them. And I want justice for all the other people whose lives are bought and sold so that a few big shots can climb up on their backs and laugh at the law and laugh at human decency.
Actress Pam Grier in the 1974 film Foxy Brown, a role that has become iconic for its depiction of the African-American female as proud, sexy, hip, and strong. This week, Grier talked to NPR's Allison Keyes on Tell Me More to talk about her film legacy.
Welcome, Ms. Grier.
Welcome, is what you're saying. I'm in shock. I was listening to my voice back in that scene. Thank you for the invitation. It just took me back. It was quite emotional. Well, I remember doing that scene, and it resonated to a lot of my community and things that I'd seen and happened, and I was really feeling every word.
It resonated in what way?
My mom was Coffee, and my aunt was Foxy Brown. And in my community in Denver, there were certain areas that were quite deprived and angry, and you could see the people preying upon one another, victimizing one another. And it was very harsh. And my mom was always, some of her friends, the mediator, trying to stop the fights, trying to stop the madness. And she was always taking care of people. And it was just, I don't know, it just moved me to hear me give that dialogue.
Pam Grier was on the show to also talk about her new memoir, Foxy, My Life in Three Acts, in which she writes about various life challenges, including being a survivor of assaults at an early age.
When you talk about surviving, you really don't know how you will survive each year. There are times where when I'm frightened and I feel uncertain, my stutter returns, and I have a mechanism that
still
controls it. Yes, it returns. And I don't know if you ever get over or survive. Some people do. I can't speak for them. I know what my difficulties are, and I am able to understand them. I've had discussions about them. The third attempt was the time when I decided I'm fighting back. It is not going to happen once more. And I remember fighting so with desperation, with all of my might, to not allow this to happen a third time.
Wow.
So I just don't want others to experience what I had. And I see it. I see dysfunctional behavior, abusive behavior in families passed on from generation to generation to generation. You see it every day. And you don't always get over it. You might split, you might hide, you might repress emotions, but it's something that will be with you forever.
But still, you write about a Jewish Talmud verse that's special to you, that says every blade of grass has an angel that bends over it and whispers, grow, grow.
Yes.
I mean, you're able to come back from that to that positive thought.
I get to a positive thought. Could it be better? Possibly. But I have so many angels, so many people in my career, from Tim and Daphne Reed to Quentin Tarantino, who invested 2 years of his life to write Jackie Brown for me. I've been fortunate. The lifelines of, you know, from doing film and having producers and directors still interested in my work, you know, it keeps me occupied. It keeps me from thinking about things that would take that positivity away from me.
She's so ultra-modern and ultra-hip. Loved that Pam Grier interview. From the ultra-modern to the Wayback Machine, we heard another installment of the year-long series 50 Great Voices. NPR's Tom Huizenga told us about legendary opera singer Enrico Caruso.
People often ask me, how did you get into opera? And I always tell them that I got bit by the opera bug because of one voice. tenor Enrico Caruso. In college, everything I read defined Caruso as the greatest. So I bought this LP for $2 in a used record shop, slapped it on the turntable, and was dumbfounded. It was like a jolt of electricity to hear the human voice sound like that, even if the year was 1907 and Caruso was singing into a metal horn. So much power, yet so smooth and warm. How did he do it? How did singing like that propel this poor kid from Naples, Italy, to the highest peaks of music? And was he really as great as everyone says? Well, to find some answers, I called up the grand arbiter of all things operatic, John Steen.
Hello.
Mr. Steen.
Yes, yes.
How are you?
Oh, fine. And yourself?
John Steen's the guy who wrote the grand tradition, 70 years of singing on record, and it's a Bible for opera geeks. Now, come to find out, Steen's first foray into opera mirrored my own. As a 9-year-old, he spent an afternoon at a friend of his aunt's. Nothing to do but rummage through the phonograph records, double-sided 78s. The titles, they all look pretty boring at first.
But there was this one record with a bright red label. I put it on, and my goodness, I mean, that to me was so exciting. I owe so much to that particular afternoon. I was hooked, hooked for life.
Incredibly cool. Caruso hooked John Steen and me. So John and I had our own little listening party. Me in Washington, him in Coventry, England.
Yes, I love those portamenti, that little caress, you know. Modern singers are taught you must be clean, go cleanly from one note to another. And yet, it isn't a matter of cleanness, it's a matter of affection. And there's so much affection here.
That kind of affection and style is exactly what Marcello Giordani aims for. He's one of today's top Italian tenors. And although Caruso's been dead for almost 90 years, his voice still haunts Giordani.
Well, I feel really miles and miles far away of his technique, because it's power, color, timbre, everything in one that unfortunately I couldn't have it in the same way that Caruso has it. His breath support was impeccable, and he shaped his lines with such emphasis on the right words. I think from what we heard, incredible, powerful, with a velvet quality, a nostalgic quality that made some people call it la voce con la lacrima, the voice with a tear.
Caruso didn't always have that tear in his voice. He was born in 1873 in Naples to a lower-class family. Nothing special about his upbringing except that he sang constantly, even as a young boy. After some training, he dreamed of a singing career. So little by little, Caruso got better and better, singing in bigger houses until around 1900, when nobody could match his unique combination of power and warm golden tones. Caruso peaked as the gramophone blossomed, and his voice rang out surprisingly clear on the primitive equipment. Just like John Steen, once I heard Caruso, I was starved for more. And over the years, I've fallen in and occasionally out of love with hundreds of opera singers from all eras, from Rosa Poncel to Renee Fleming, from Beniamino Gigli to Ben Heppner. But Caruso, he's never bowed out from that tiny opera stage in my head. Caruso was a megastar in his day, but what does that mean these days? I took an informal survey around the office, and Only about 2 of 20 people said the name even rang a bell.
This is a tragedy.
It bothers people like John Steen. You'd think the fact that all of Caruso's records are still in print would mean something.
The recording, you know, to put it in a rather dramatic way, I mean, it involved a triumph over death. It ensured immortality. But of course, there's no immortality if people aren't listening.
And if I had my way, more people would take notice of Caruso's soaring golden voice. After all, that's the reason I wanted to tell this story. Tom Huizinga, NPR News.
Elizabeth, you produced the series 50 Great Voices. What's been the most fun for you so far?
Many people who are doing 50 Great Voices stories are bringing their personal affection for whatever singer they're talking about. And that is by far what I love most about the series.
Yeah, no, I loved it. He really geeked out in it. And
totally.
And I thought he brought great energy. And, you know, I was one of those listeners who doesn't really care about opera, but all of a sudden became, you know, he did raise my interest level. And I got it. I felt like I got it with this guy and with this piece.
Yeah, or even just if you didn't get it, you sort of got, you heard one person's obsession with
right.
this singer and why.
No, you appreciate his love.
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah.
Anyone can hear past installments of 50 Great Voices on our website, npr.org.
We switch from singing to writing for an interview with Irish author Roddy Doyle. This was a fantastic interview. His new novel, The Dead Republic, is the final book in a trilogy about the fictional Henry Smart, who over the course of 3 books has been both a foot soldier in the Irish War for Independence and the manager of a young Louis Armstrong in New York City. In The Dead Republic, Henry is working for the famous American movie director John Ford. At the end of the discussion, NPR's Lynn Neary asked Doyle about the power of the arts in defining Irish culture.
In many ways, Ireland is a very self-conscious place because of, say, the Irish-American links, because we speak English. We seem to punch beyond our weight, so to speak, that who controls what it is to be Irish and what it is that we can be comfortable with seems to me vitally important. And it's happening again now in many ways because the economy, as you're probably aware, has hit, if not rock bottom, pretty close. And I suppose while the bankers and the politicians have let us down, culture really hasn't. And suddenly the power of books and literature and, to a lesser extent, I suppose, film has come to the fore again. My concern about that is that who's going to define that culture? Will it be us, the citizens of Ireland, who actually live there? Or will it be some sort of marketing department of the civil service who will try to define what Irish culture is in the hopes of enticing people to arrive and spend their money? So, you know, definitely when I was a kid, if you didn't speak Irish, you really wanted to. And you played Gaelic games and you didn't pay any attention to what was happening in the outside world because really Ireland was the centre of the universe. And I don't think that's the case anymore. Although, admittedly, it is the centre of the universe.
Now on to film and a mashup between Bollywood and telenovelas. Here's NPR's film critic Bob Mondello.
When I say Bollywood, you think what? Lush romance, fantastical landscapes, colorful costumes, elaborate musical numbers that may not have much to do with the plot, maybe a 3-hour running time? All perfectly reasonable. You probably don't expect this.
You've stolen $2 million from my casino.
I want you to look at every hotel, every casino, every nook and cranny.
Welcome to Las Vegas, by way of Bollywood, by way of telenovelas, which is to say, welcome to Kites, a picture that has nothing to do with actual kites, but includes pretty much anything else you can think of. Scuba diving, a deadly wedding shootout, bodies falling prettily off cliffs, bullets falling prettily into glasses of whiskey, exploding police cars that flip through the air like breakdancers, actual breakdancers, and a chase sequence that leaps from pickup truck to hot air balloon. Oh, and on top of all that, it's trilingual, English, Spanish, and a little Hindi, just for fans. The leading lady, played by ravishing telenovela star Barbara Mori, speaks Spanish and a little English, but no Hindi, though she'd like to, because she's falling in love.
I am saying, I love you in India.
Main ullu ki patti hoon.
He's kidding. What that phrase actually means is, I am a stupid girl. The leading man, who's played by Indian heartthrob Hrithik Roshan, with charisma, humor, and even occasionally a shirt, speaks Hindi and English, but no Spanish.
How do you say, I love you in Spanish?
Me estoy haciendo caca.
Me estoy what?
Haciendo caca.
I should probably pass on translating that one. Let's just say she's kidding, too. Both stars are sexy, funny, and easy on the eyes. They're also downright heroic about the Tarantino-style mayhem that seems to lurk around every plot curve. Hoping to click with Western audiences, Kites has a lot of mayhem for a Bollywood picture. And just in case it's still not enough, the filmmakers have taken out what you might call insurance. They've gotten Brett Ratner, the director of the Rush Hour movies that made Jackie Chan popular in this country, to create a second version of Kites. It's called Kites the Remix, and cuts the already pretty snappy 130-minute original down to an even zippier 90 minutes. Less romance, less backstory, and no dance numbers. There was only one, anyway. That'll leave mostly chase sequences, and speaking of chasing, that version is zooming into theaters just 7 days from now. A big push to make Kites fly, and maybe make Bollywood as mainstream here as Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon made martial arts. I'm Bob Mondello.
Elizabeth, you had a fun look at another film, the latest in the Sex and the City franchise, and this time Carrie Bradshaw and her girlfriends were not in New York City.
Sex and the City has always been laced with fantasy. Writer-producer Michael Patrick King says in a recession, that was more important than ever. He says he took his cues from filmmakers who worked during the Depression.
And all of a sudden they started doing Top Hat and extravagant getaway things and road pictures and far, far away adventures, and I thought, that's my job.
For Carrie, Miranda, Charlotte, and Samantha, the Arab world is exotic.
Desert moons, Scheherazade, magic carpets.
Camels.
Oh, can you hear me now? Harry! Miranda, I'm home!
Camels, Abu Dhabi. No?
I've been to Abu Dhabi several times, and believe me, I've been everywhere in Abu Dhabi, and I couldn't find a camel.
Dr. Jack Shaheen has written extensively on how Muslims and Arabs have been portrayed in American movies.
No matter where the film is shot, inevitably we're going to have camels, and we're going to have the desert and some tents. I mean, that's how Hollywood traditionally defines the Middle East.
Now, Sex and the City 2 isn't pretending this is real. Even the press materials acknowledge they had to go to West Africa to get the camels. The film was shot in Morocco, not Abu Dhabi. And throughout, the photography, the clothes, the music are stunning, if not authentic. Michael Patrick King.
We didn't kid around. We really went there and made a big, old-fashioned Hollywood movie, but hopefully with a current sensibility involved.
What's the sense in a boring business dinner when you have sand dunes and sunset?
Michael Patrick King references lots of old movies, including the screwball comedies from the 1930s and 40s.
I hear this country's where they do the dance of the seven veils.
Like Road to Morocco with Bing Crosby and Bob Hope. Interesting choice, says Jack Shaheen.
Road to Morocco is probably one of the most stereotypical films ever to come out of Hollywood.
At one point, Bob Hope is in full Sultan-esque attire. In Sex and the City, Carrie Bradshaw wears a turban designed by Philip Tracy of London. Depending on your point of view, she either looks silly or fashion-forward. Michael Patrick King.
Pat Field and I, the costume designer, had major conversations about how to be creative and cover the shoulders to be respectful for the customs. And what they came up with was this intricate and almost undefinable collection of scarves and shirts that turned into shruggings and jackets. And it's so funny because when Carrie finally does drop her jacket and show her shoulders, it's almost as if she's naked.
But there are no harem girls or snake charmers in this Sex and the City. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News. So from the big screen to the small screen, Michelle Norris and Melissa Black from All Things Considered spoke to a couple of bloggers about the end of the television series Lost.
After nearly 6 years and 121 episodes, the TV thriller Lost is over.
The finale aired on ABC last night. Michelle, I may be the only person in America who did not watch it. I'm really out of the loop on this one.
Well, I don't watch the show regularly, so Lost would explain my state of mind since I only watched the last 10 minutes. But there are a group of Lost bloggers and podcasters who have spent the last few years absolutely obsessing over the show.
And we wondered, what are they going to do now with all of their free time?
Well, we asked the father and son duo who host the Lost podcast with Jay and Jack.
Here are Jack and Jay Gladfelter.
So many people have asked us to do a Lost rewatch, and it's like, well, you know, all right, we'll do a Lost rewatch. And
we're going to go back and watch the series from the beginning to the end. We're going to discuss it and kind of look at the entire show.
And after I do the Lost rewatch, then I'm going to watch it just for myself. And
your re-rewatch.
My re-rewatch, just for me.
The Washington Post has its own blogging duo. Jen Chaney and Liz Kelly write about Lost for the blog Celebritology.
And although they blog about After nearly 6 years and 121 episodes, the TV thriller Lost is over.
The finale aired on ABC last night. Michelle, I may be the only person in
Alltech blog. That's at npr.org/alltech. After nearly 6 years and 121 episodes, the TV thriller Lost is over.
The finale aired on ABC last night. Michelle, I may be the only person in America who did not watch it. I'm really out of the loop on this one.
Well, I don't watch the show regularly, so Lost would explain my state of mind since I only watched the last 10 minutes. But there are a group of Lost bloggers and podcasters who have spent the last few years absolutely obsessing over the show.
And we wondered, what are they going to do now with all of their free time?
Well, we asked the father and son duo who host the Lost podcast with Jay and Jack.
Here are Jack and Jay Gladfelter.
So many people have asked us to do a Lost rewatch, and it's like, well, you know, all right, we'll do a Lost rewatch. And
we're going to go back and watch the series from the beginning to the end. We're going to discuss it and kind of look at the entire show.
And after I do the Lost rewatch, then I'm going to watch it just for myself. And
your re-rewatch.
My re-rewatch, just for me.
The Washington Post has its own blogging duo. Jen Chaney and Liz Kelly write about Lost for the blog Celebritology.
And although they blog about other shows, they say there's nothing quite like Lost.
I like Modern Family and I love Glee, but they don't have the same kind of rich mythology that Lost had. And that show just also happened to strike at the right moment in terms of internet culture, in terms of social media. Going online is as much a part of the show as watching the show itself.
Right, and because of the rabid nature of the Lost fan community, I don't see this dissipating. So I think as the discussion continues over the next month, we're going to continue to cover the show, you know, even if there aren't new episodes, if there are new revelations, new theories that make sense, we're going to stay on top of it.
So much for free time. These bloggers and podcasters are still stuck on the island.
I have to say, I'm a little jealous of the bloggers for never getting off the island. I wish I didn't have to get off the island. I was very bittersweet that it ended. I did like the ending. I don't know if you're a fan, Elizabeth.
I don't watch Lost. I know. I don't know what the big deal is, but only because I haven't seen it. But
yeah, well,
I'm too busy watching Sex and the City. No.
It's definitely worth if you ever Netflix, but I do. Yeah, I'm a little, you know, I'm in black today, just thinking about the end of Lost. We have mixed emotions this week. Well, we've saved some music to wrap things up today. Jazz violinist Regina Carter visited NPR recently to talk about her new CD. Robert Siegel fills us in on the rest.
Her new CD, Reverse Thread, marks a new direction for her. Here she is with a choral player and an accordionist. It's an album of contemporary interpretations of African folk songs. Regina Carter, thank you. That was beautiful.
Thank you.
What was that tune?
That was a piece entitled Interi, and it means friendship. It was written by a great guitarist and songwriter from Mali, and his name is Habib Koité.
Now, we should unpack the trio here for a moment. We heard you on violin.
Yes.
Listeners with an encyclopedic memory may recall you used to play Paganini's violin
yes.
at one time, but you don't have that instrument.
No, I have my Walmart special. No, I have my violin with me now.
Good. And we have, as well,
Will Holthauser on accordion.
On accordion.
And we have Yakuba Sissoko on kora.
The kora.
Yes.
And you should describe the kora for our listeners.
The kora is a West African harp, And Yakuba actually made his kora, and he learned the instrument from his grandfather. And what's amazing with Yakuba is that he also understands the Western scale system. So we can play any key, and he can tune and play every tune with us, whereas a lot of kora players usually can only stay in the one key. So we're very lucky to have Yakuba and his talents with us.
What do you play next, Trish?
The next piece is Hewombe Owumba, and it's from Uganda. It's from the Ugandan Jews, actually. And the translation is God Creates, Then He Destroys, which sounds like a very dark title, but the song is very lighthearted. Hewombe Owumba.
That's it for this week. We'll let Regina Carter's music take us out as we thank you for checking in.
You can subscribe to this podcast on our website, npr.org/culturetopia. I'm Justine Kennan.
And I'm Elizabeth Blair. Thank you.